You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education podcast. I'm at the University of Hertfordshire with Vice Chancellor Professor Quintin McKellar. Nice to meet you.
Hello.
Hi there. We're speaking the day after A-level results, so that seems a fairly good place to start. Clearing's in full flow. I've just had a tour of your facilities. What's it like to be the sort of head of a university during the annual scramble that is clearing and A-level results day?
It's very exciting. Of course, it can be a little nerve-wracking before the phones start ringing, but from essentially 7:30 yesterday morning, the phones did start ringing, so it was very reassuring. And certainly we've been getting a huge amount of interest in the places that we have remaining at the university. And the quality of the students that are phoning up is very good, so we're in a pretty strong position and happy with how things are going.
Last year was a strange one, of course. A lot of universities found themselves short on numbers, not as many people getting the golden ticket of AAB as was expected, and ABB this year. How badly hit were you last year?
It affected us a little, but we had decided before clearing started that we were going to hold very firm to quite high tariffs. Clearly, if we had dropped our tariffs, we would have had, because we had, as many universities, we had 30,000 applicants last year, so we had plenty of applicants. But it was we were affected a little bit. Our numbers were down somewhat, but they appear to have bounced back this year, because, I mean, we don't know yet because we're not fully through clearing, but we're ahead today from where we were this time last year, and the phones still seem to be ringing quite frequently in the clearing room. So I'm confident that we'll meet our target this year.
Yeah, they were still ringing 5 minutes ago.
I can
vouch for that. And how did you adjust? You said you were some way short last year. Did you find yourself making more, making more offers this time around?
No, we haven't, because the way the student number control works, in essence, for us, we're looking at a finite number which we agree in advance within the university, and we have a budgeted number that we're going for. And that's balancing, of course, the resources available to us, the number of academic staff we have, the accommodation and so on. And effectively, I think we'll reach what we want in terms of numbers at this university while maintaining quite high tariff rates, which is great for us because it's improving the quality of the students that we get.
And do you think the current system, sort of whereby students get their AS level results, maybe some predictive results, and then sort of slightly in the dark as to where they might actually end up in university until the last second, do you think that system's the best way to decide where youngsters end up going to university? I mean, in other countries, you'd wait until you had the actual results.
No, I absolutely not is the answer to the question. But in a sense, because of the complexity of the situation in the UK, both where we have a requirement in some universities and for some courses in most universities to do interviews, that adds a level of complexity to what you might call post-qualification admissions systems. There is an argument made also that the time between the results becoming available and the start of an academic term makes it very difficult to do post-qualification admissions in the UK. I don't personally believe that. I think we could move the times of exam outcomes and or the times of start of academic term in order to fit a system which would allow post-qualification admissions. But there has been a huge debate on that over the last 2 years, and essentially it has been rejected as a possibility, at least in the current thinking within higher education in this country.
As a VC, how much easier would that make your job if you could know for a fact what people had when they applied?
Well, I think it would be firstly easier. I also personally think it would be a bit fairer, because you could essentially, if all the qualifications were known, you could essentially rank all the prospective students' numbers 1 to 40,000 or whatever it would be, and then give them, in that sort of ranking scheme, choice of going to university, and universities could accept or reject on that basis. And I think it would be a fairer system.
You'd have to be quite an Excel whiz to put that all on a spreadsheet.
You absolutely would.
Interesting. And Moving on, Hertfordshire won the Times Higher Entrepreneurial University of the Year a couple of years back. You yourself have written for the THE about the importance of work placements in degrees. Why is this something that you've sort of taken up? Why is this of such importance to you?
We've, as well as being very much a business-facing university, we've also, as a university, been trying to think quite deeply about the attributes that we want our students to have. And because we're business-facing, clearly some of those attributes relate to professionalism, to enterprise, to entrepreneurialism, and to critical thinking and problem solving. And we absolutely believe that students pick up those skills and attributes in the workplace, as well as obviously during timetable teaching and so on. And so we would actually, if we could, we would love for this university to have a system where all students did placements of one sort or another in a mandatory fashion. We can't get there yet. I think perhaps at some point in the future we'll move towards that.
Why can't you get there?
Well, if I can just suggest, it's easier to do that where you have four-year degree courses. Scotland and the Republic of Ireland in particular, and there are a number of universities which have moved very robustly to ensuring that they do have mandatory placement schemes almost along the sandwich year type. But you can do it in those circumstances because there are three long vacation periods within which an appropriate length placement can be fitted. It's more difficult with three-year degree courses such as the ones we have here. Mm-hmm. However, not impossible, and it could be done. The second reason that we find it difficult to do, we currently have more businesses out there asking for placement students than we have placement students who want to fill those places. But the difficulty is not a direct equality of numbers issue. The difficulty is that while it's quite easy to fit placements for instance, business students, because they can go into almost any business and get a very worthwhile educational placement within that business, where, for instance, you're wanting to place an engineer, you have to find an appropriate business which is dealing, obviously, in engineering in one way or another to place them. And it's actually matching the type of placement with the student and their particular requirements as a student for what would be a beneficial educational placement. Now, that's not to say that they wouldn't still get a benefit from doing a placement in essentially any business, because they would. It would add to the professionalism, it would add to the problem-solving skills and so on. But I think it would be better if we had a bigger pool of potential placements which matched more effectively the sort of requirements that our students have. So that there's complexity there. That doesn't mean it's impossible. And clearly, as a university, that's one of our targets and something that we will work towards.
So you're actually looking at it as a...
Absolutely. Not an immediate target, but one for a sort of longer-term strategic plan.
Sure. I mean, Hertfordshire obviously was a former polytechnic, now one of the world's top universities, if you believe our World University Rankings, which of course we do. Others haven't maybe made the step quite so effectively, and there's been a bit of a trend recently for saying that institutions made an error perhaps when they changed from polytechnics to university. Maybe the name should be brought back, they say, sort of to boost the reputation of more vocational courses. I think that was the IPPR think tank. I mean, you're sort of at the head of a former poly that's blossoming. What are your thoughts on that issue?
Well, I think the polytechnics were wonderful institutions in the United Kingdom, and of course, Hatfield Polytechnic, which was the predecessor of the University of Hertfordshire, was one of the better ones, and was and had a very important part to play in Hertfordshire and indeed in the east of England as an educational and vocational training facility. Of course, 20 years has passed since we became a university, and during that time we've expanded, we've increased our diversity, we've embraced arts, creative arts faculty, we've embraced humanities activity, we've embraced a business school. So we've moved substantially beyond, I think, what the primary purpose of a polytechnic was. Now, that's not to say that it wouldn't be appropriate, perhaps, to invent something equivalent to the polytechnics, but I don't think simply converting those universities which perhaps were polytechnics previously back into polytechnics would be a sensible way forward, because they've all moved forward so substantially in that time, and they've all developed a lot of the particular criteria which apply to universities about the creation of knowledge, the dissemination of knowledge, which, yes, were important for polytechnics, but at a different level and in a different way. So I think polytechnics were fabulous institutions, but it would, and were a particular government wanting to reinvent polytechnics, I think they should do it de novo, in the sense, rather than trying to fit what are now probably square pegs back into round holes.
Sure. I thought since we're here, we should ask a little bit about the finances of running a university. Your finance director, Alistair Moffat, I believe, formerly worked for the budget airline Monarch. It's an industry famous for, well, financial savvy, for innovative approaches to getting cash in. Has any of that rubbed off on Hertfordshire University? I mean, do students have to pay more if they bring more luggage, for example?
No. Well, indeed, of course, you're probably aware that we are one of the universities which entered the new tuition fee regime at a lower fee level. Mm-hmm. So we were offering what we consider to be best value for money in the sector for students coming to this university. But Alistair, as a finance director, has been wonderful for the university, because he's absolutely ensured that our finances are in a very robust state. And he did that, obviously, for Monarch Airlines. Incidentally, he did it for a bus company before that. And, of course, you may be aware that we have UNO buses, which belong to the university. So he's using his skills in many ways within the university. But he brings to the university a clarity with regard to financial management, which I think we benefit from enormously. And I guess that's been honed by working in what is quite a ruthless business in terms of the airline business, or, for that matter, in a bus company.
Mm. So UNO Buses, for those who don't know, is a company owned by the university that both students and the members of the general public can use to get, is there a number of routes, or between campus and town?
Oh, many routes. It was originally established because prior to moving the various colleges which formed the university onto a single campus, we had a requirement to bring students from some more distant colleges onto the main site, and so it was established really to transport students, but the company kept being asked by members of the public if they could also get on the bus, so it was expanded to make it a public service, which it is now, and we run services which by and large cater specifically for, or we have a preference for routes which cater for students and which lead to areas where students live. But we also have routes which are simply run because they make profit.
So you're running a bus company.
We're running a bus company.
And the profits come back to the university.
Absolutely.
Interesting stuff. It's just occurred to me the timing. We're coming up towards the next Research Excellence Framework submission. We've covered a number of stories about people sort of gaming the ref, not suggesting for a second it's Hertfordshire. In fact, it hasn't been. But, there's fears that there will be repercussions for staff who aren't submitted. I mean, just how much as a VC do you feel that pressure, and how do you sort of shape your university's approach to that? So what is a very sort of harrowing and difficult time for, it's a very testing time for academics.
Well, we fundamentally believe that research is important for undergraduate and indeed postgraduate education. We think it's a fundamental principle of a university that it has a rich research ethos. And that applies to the University of Hertfordshire as it does to many. And as a consequence, we obviously would like our return from the REF to be extremely positive. Having said that, in terms of our overall budget, the income that we derive from the outcome of the REF would be substantially less than it would be for a research intensive university like one of the Russell Group. So while, in my opinion, the REF is deeply important to us from a reputational perspective, and it's important to us because we want to have that research activity across the university. It's less important to us from a financial perspective. So in essence, we would not be putting pressure on members of staff the way some universities are in terms of their performance in REF. That doesn't mean that we don't want them to be research engaged and research active, and for that matter, wanting them to utilise that research activity in their undergraduate and postgraduate teaching, because we absolutely do. But I think the REF as an exercise, probably we treat in a slightly different way than perhaps the Russell Group would, or a research intensive university would.
Sure. You mentioned fees there as well. I'd just like to come back to that very quickly. So what's the average annual fee for a course at Harvard?
We were below 7,500 to start with. We've gone up, and we'll be next year 8,500 will be the average fee across the university. That's before you take off all the bursaries and stuff which support students.
So it's creeping up towards that maximum 9k. I mean, is that something that you envisage happening ultimately? And what made you change your approach?
A very clear realization after the first year that the system as it exists has not made students price sensitive. There are lots of things which make students choose which university to go to, and I think the reputation of the university clearly is more important to students, and presumably also their parents, than the price tag which is being put against. Also, I think students perceive that the loan schemes which are available are extremely beneficial, if I can put it like that. They're good loan schemes, which mean that actually differentiating on price probably has not had a big impact on attendance.
Yeah, there were concerns that message hadn't got across. Yeah. Certainly it seems our experience that the parents often haven't grasped that it's not an upfront fee, but the students, as you say, do seem to be a lot more informed about what these costs mean. Were you surprised then when by the number of universities that did charge £9,000 when that was announced? Were you a bit like, oh, well, we should have charged more?
I wasn't surprised. We didn't think we should have charged more because in the first instance we were wanting to offer the best value for money, and we did think that might have been a particularly attractive offer for students. But in essence, it became apparent very quickly that those universities which were charging £9,000 were still remaining attractive to students, and it wasn't that they were having a problem filling their places. So. And also, of course, there has been inflation. And having started slightly lower, we have the opportunity, of course, to add inflationary increases in the years until we get to 9,000.
And a little bit more, maybe.
Possibly.
You yourself, you've been at Hertfordshire now for 2.5 years. What's changed at the university since you came? I guess, why did you take the job initially, and how has the first 2.5 years been?
Well, I took the job because I thought it was a fantastic opportunity. It's a wonderful university. It's got a lot of the attributes as a university that I personally ascribe to. I mean, that sort of business, very much business-facing, very much a can-do university. It's got great people who are very positive. So all that was very attractive to me. And since I've been here, I hope that we've begun to embed further those characteristics of the university. But we've done so also in an environment where the university, just to take a step back, when I came, had a wonderful campus which embraced the part of the university on the west side of the A1, the de Havilland campus. The east side is the old site, which comprises the College Lane campus, where the original Polytechnic was established. And indeed, it's the part which was donated to the university by the then chairman of the de Havilland Aircraft Company. But as a consequence, it's now 60 years old. And there's a substantial amount of work required. And as you can see yourself looking around, we're in the process of undertaking that work. Mm-hmm. So we're essentially building a complete new student centre, which will be a focus for student activity in the broadest sense, everything from registration to counselling. And we're building a whole new student village, which I think will offer really terrific facilities and accommodation for our students in the future. But that means that there is a period of significant change going on in terms of the building within the university here. In terms of education, I think the main drive which we've had was a move from fundamental skills and knowledge to a drive towards creating attributes in students. That's not to say that we don't still believe that they need to have the skills and knowledge within their particular discipline area when they leave, but we also want them to go out of here with a characteristic professionalism that is, if you like, recognised as a Hertfordshire student or a Hertfordshire graduate.
I noticed when I arrived, on top of your car is a, I imagine it's a rowboat, it might be a canoe, I'm not sure. I know you're a former Commonwealth rower, is that right? Any plans to put that on the curriculum as a compulsory part?
No, I'm actually going rowing this weekend, but it's just for fun. No, but we do, I mean, I have to say that we do have a most marvellous sports village at the university. It's probably a sector leading sports facility that we have here. Also open to the public, it's a facility which is used by the community, but it does mean that we have wonderful facilities for not just rowing but a whole range of sports, notably at this university, sports like basketball, netball, hockey, football, which are we're probably best at, if you like.
Very good. Well, Professor Quinton McKellar, thanks for talking to me today. And we'll be back with another interview podcast very soon.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.